Right now I'd like to interview our moderator. Rather than come up with something original to say, I'll just read what it says in the program. Jim Cable is our moderator. Jim is a senior writer at ESPN.com. Contributes a weekly baseball off-base column and other humor to the wildly popular Page 2 webpage, as well as other sports assignments for ESPN Magazine, ESPN News, and SportsCenter. He's a graduate of the University of Washington, has worked for the Bellevue Journal-American, St. Paul Pioneer Press, and Seattle PI. His first book, The Devil Wears Pinstripes, was released by Boom Books in 2005, available from Amazon.com. Jim lives in the Seattle area with his wife, Vicki, and he rode his bike over here across Lake Washington this morning. So he's a little sweaty, but you're not too close to him, so that shouldn't bother you. Jim Cable.
Early, and I know I'm sweaty from my bike ride, but for some reason I feel like pounding Budweiser right now. In my years as a baseball writer, I've had the great privilege to speak many times with our Commissioner Bud Selig, and usually the interview subject is about teams and team relocation, particularly Minnesota. And he many times would tell me how important a Major League Baseball team is to the community. And he would tell me about the heartache and the heartbreak he felt when the Braves left Milwaukee. And I don't know if I ever actually said it to him, but in the back of my mind was always, yeah, I know exactly how you feel. Like, you stole our Pirates. The Seattle Pilots were in existence for only one year, one magic year, 1969. And yet, thanks to the literary expertise of one of our panelists, we have them forever. Ball 4 has been named by the New York Public Library as one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century. I think that shortchanges it. I've read the book probably a dozen times, beginning with when I was 12 years old, and I'm happy to say that every time I read it, I find one more sexual reference that I understand. I know that Roy Smith, who pitched a number of years for the Pirates and the Twins and other teams, was one of his favorite books, and I asked him one time how many times he's read it. And he said, are you kidding? I keep it in a very special place, right next to the toilet, so that I can read it anytime, along with my other favorite book, The Godfather. Anyway, it's my privilege and great pleasure to be able to introduce Jim Ballard. Seattle Pilots lost a few more games than they won that year, but little did we know that there was a little did the coaching staff understand that there was a future Cy Young winner on the staff. Mike Marshall pitched for a number of teams, including the Los Angeles Dodgers, for whom he won the 1974 Cy Young. And if you ever want to look back at a statistical line and wonder, what the hell is going on? How did he do that? Just read the 1974 line. 106 games, 208 innings pitched, all in relief. And Mike was more than a great pitcher, though. He was also instrumental in the Players Union, and I know how important he was in the early days of the union and how effective he was, because a dozen years later, when I was covering the Twins, they were still cursing your name. He played for the Red Sox, he played for the Athletics, played alongside Carl Yastrzemski and Roberto Clemente, Catfish Hunter, and then he came to Seattle and he played for the Pilots. And that was where his career, I think he decided that's enough. since then, currently he is working with the Catfish Hunter ALS Foundation and is doing very good work there. And I hope you can get him to talk about that today and about what's going on with ALS. Jim Baker. My brother-in-law, who said he was very, very popular with the college students at the time, I guess we could, it was there, but Steve Oley also had the great distinction of playing for the Pilots and going to spring training and thinking that he was going to spend the next summer in beautiful Seattle, where there is the best summers in the world, and then finding out at the last second he was going to spend it instead in Milwaukee. But we have a little bit of thank for that. Anyway, a very good outfielder, Steve Oley. And I'll just open up for the first question to I think an easy question for people. Just let me ask what your memories are, your thoughts are of Sick Stadium, or as I like to refer to it, the Camden Yards of the Rainier Valley. Anybody with a distinct memory of Sick Stadium, perhaps the showers?
I thought the walls were a little too close.
Sick Stadium, I think that was is a hardware store, so we can't go back there to see it, but I remember talking one time with Mike Keegan, who said that on opening day, they actually were in the bleachers still pounding, or still constructing the wooden seats out there in the bleachers. Does anybody remember that, or remember anything else about 6-8?
I remember they had people waiting in line when they would nail down another plank.
Schultz stuck me out in right field one night just because he wanted to. And the fence was in close enough.
You played in Fenway Park in Forbes Field. How was it playing in Majestic 6-8?
Actually, in my career, I enjoyed it because it really had an intimate feeling being closer to the fans. That's really what I got out of it.
Jim, I know you've been in Safeco. How does it compare to Safeco?
Well, the view from the mound, which is in aisle 3 by one of the cash registers, you don't get a clear view of the batter, the sculpture that sits outside, about 20 feet outside the ballpark. But it's interesting to stand in the hardware store as I did, stand on that mound and try to imagine all that's gone and what the stands were like and where Mount Rainier might have been, which I think was over near the Hammers.
Jim, in addition to running ball four, has perhaps the distinction of being the first official Seattle Pilot, although I think Tom Kelly might have a bit of a discussion or an argument on that part. Jim actually signed with the Seattle team, or was sold to the Seattle team, in June of 68, almost a year before they actually began play. Tom Kelly, former manager of the Twins, was drafted in June of 68 by the Pilots. He's one of these first players under contract as well. Why do you think that the Pilots resonate so much with so many people, obviously, here?
To me, it's all what might have been. I loved playing in Seattle. Sick Stadium, I don't remember anything about how close the walls were or anything like that. What I remember was the friendliness of the place. I thought you had it just right. You felt comfortable there. You felt you had people that were on your side there. And while we were learning, and certainly that was a big learning year for me, it was just beginning to put my game together. And I was looking forward to having an opportunity. Now, it happened that, I don't know if anybody here remembers this, but I got mugged in Cleveland. If you want to get mugged, go to Cleveland. Right outside the hotel. I mean, they don't bother to get you now. They just got right. Joe thought I could just still did. That's just a separation. So, and I was dumb enough. You know, young kid, you don't know any better. You're going to give it a try. You don't need to keep trying. And it took Myrna and I reached for a respectful three something up into, I don't know, some stratosphere number, and then decided maybe I can't pitch. But I look forward to coming back. You live here. You know the place. It's gorgeous. You love the, like you said, the summers are gorgeous. But I thought that I also was with Montreal when they were outside in Parc de Ries. Well, I couldn't understand what they were saying. I think it was friendly. It was smiling for the most part. Here you can understand what they're saying. It's a friendly group. And what I liked about it, if you weren't somebody important, you were somebody playing ball. I know that may not rub some of you correctly, but that's all it is. Guys playing ball, we're just like you, we're just playing ball. You guys are the working stiff. You guys out there pounding, we're playing ball. There's no reason to look at us like we're something really special. We just left, love to play ball, and we have some genetics to do it. And I like that trait. I like people to come up and say, hi, how you doing? I want to know how you're doing, and how you're doing as a baseball player. And that's what I got from the people in Seattle. And you come into the parking lot, you park there, and the guy greeting you there was like that, you know, like you're a buddy, not a ball player. And that's the thing that I like about it. When you get into, and I played in L.A., and, you know, stalkers. You know, not all folks. We love to play baseball. We like to be friendly. And we don't need people to look at us with glassy eyes. All right? We're not that. We do the same things you do. I love that about Seattle. I wanted to come back, but then they got rid of me before, and I had to go down to Houston. Like, where did I have?
He doesn't like it when we drink and fight and smoke and screw. Home at our game each day, and what the fuck can Harry say? It makes a fellow proud to be an
Astro. I said Harry Walker, God rest his soul. I played for Danny Murtaugh, who was like my father, and then Harry came over because of Danny's health, I believe. But my experience as a player rep for the Pirates and being with a great team of guys, and then Harry Walker came on the scene, in my estimation, Harry managed my results. Tell all of us can do that. That's not hard. But one night we're playing in Pittsburgh, and Milwaukee comes in. Joe Torre's on a hitting streak, and we pitchers, catchers go over to how we're going to pitch the hitters, da 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 da. And Harry says, well, now, this is how we're going to pitch Joe Torre. Well, first inning, Torre comes up in the bottom, top of the first. Call a slider, he rips it off the left center field wall for a double. I go in there, and Harry Walker said, how the hell can you throw any curveball? About the fifth inning, he comes up again. He says, don't throw him any more curveballs. Threw the slider, he rips it out of the park for a home run, too. Make a long story short, in the sixth, seventh inning, hits another double or something. He's 3-for-3. Harry Walker's going insane. And then the fourth time he came up, in about the ninth inning, he's 4-for-4. He hits another double or something. He's like, got 5 RBIs. Now, I'm running in after the inning's over, and Harry said, how the hell could you throw him a changeup? I said, it's the only damn pitch we had left.
In spring training, the Seattle Pilots made one of the great trades in Seattle sports history when they traded a young man named Lou Piniella to the Kansas City Royals for John Gelnar. And that's my favorite bit of Pilots trivia, is that on the day that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, John Gelnar lost both ends of a doubleheader. Well, Lou Piniella went on to become the Rookie of the Year and a very good player for many years, and an exceptional manager. Let's look at open up to anybody. What are your memories? What are your what we pulse on the talent of Buffalo?
The tip-off on the Seattle management is that here they are in their town, and they're not sitting up here to explain themselves.
The Seattle Mariners, finally, after almost 30 years, are finally recognizing the Seattle Pilots with a turn back the clock day on July 9th. In typical Seattle Mariners fashion, they're holding it when Pilots are out of town. But but at least they are finally recognizing, which is a great thing. There are always management problems that we can look to. Anybody else? Mike, do you have thoughts about, you talked about the shoulder separation, other thoughts about what the how management?
Well, I was a young kid in 69 just trying to get a career going. So I didn't get to talk to general managers. The person I got to talk to most of the time was, what was his name? We're in Washington, D.C. I want to watch the game. We're out there, we got this bench fence there to sit back. So I'm up there, I want to watch these hitters. So I'm trying to watch. Well, Bill McCann, of course, is hitting. So I turn it around, and I'm watching here. I want to see how he's striking. I'm a dummy. I'm actually studying the game. I might have to pitch this guy. I want to know what he can do. So I'm studying in there. I'm watching him. I'm watching closely. After my shoulder turn, what's that? Pretty heavy. Oh, there's something for him. Thanks for the coaching, Ted. Conversation I had with Sal. Now, Sal, God love him. He is a marvelous person. We had a lot of conversations about other things than baseball, where we greatly enjoyed ourselves. But he, high and tight, blown away with a slider. High and tight, blown away with a slider. That's how he pitched. Great. Screwball, don't throw it. I'm going to say, I won a Cy Young, I was second Cy Young, I was third, I was seventh twice. I think the screwball pretty good. How many did he win?
If you take the term screwball and add that to knuckleball, they had to get rid of that kind of word and that kind of thinking. They were looking to get rid of guys who thought didn't fit in, were not really baseball guys. If you didn't chew tobacco and spit and get your uniform all dirty, then you were a suspect. So they kept those guys and got rid of guys like Mike Marshall, who could think and have some character to them. They didn't want to get rid of that. So that was the second thing that hurt them, was getting rid of the guys that they discovered were not their kind of people. But the first mistake was right in spring training, and they decided, or when they were drafting, they decided they were going to try to win the pennant. So instead of building for the future and getting Pinella, they were getting rid of guys like Pinella. And getting guys whose careers were all behind them, we all know what happened.
Although in their defense, there really wasn't a future to build for since Celik moved them. But perhaps if they built better, they might have drawn a little more than 600,000 people, which I think we have more people here today to see you guys.
Guys like you, he's still playing.
But I thought they only had about 25,000 seating capacity. So given that, I remember seeing people out there. I thought full place one time. I remember I set up the Washington team on a two hitter one night. I thought I was playing in a World Series game. I mean, the support was unbelievable. These people were involved in the game. I don't think it was a big stadium. As I recall, there were only about 25. Maybe you guys can correct me. But it was nothing, the enthusiasm didn't take care of, so whatever they drew, had they had more room, I'm sure they'd have had that many more. I loved it. It was great.
Jim, do you have, the industry, and I call baseball an industry, it's simply, if you look at what's happening today, and I congratulate, I think a lot of this came from rural communities that had minor league baseball. It really have the support system to get the active community involved. And I think the days of the cookie-cutter municipal stadiums where these stadiums could be all things to all people all year for the revenue that it produced, What happened was there was a tremendous disconnect from the fan to the athlete, and then you apply the fact of the huge contracts. No longer was a fan close to the fence eating a hot dog or a buck, drinking a beer, shaking hands with Jim Bob or any of us. And to me, that's really what happened quite a long time ago that desensitized, I think, the emotional side of the game. And today, if you see Coors Field, field here, Camden Yards, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, they're all building the old-style stadiums. If you go into San Francisco ballpark, there's not a bad seat in the stadium, even if you're at the top. You're looking right down on the field. You're close to the ball players. You walk around the bleachers, circling around. You can almost look out and feel like you're touching the athlete. You're trying to get that connection back. If you look at the economics of minor league baseball, they're all successful. I know the owner of the River Cats in Sacramento, he bought it for a tax loss. Most successful business, he says, I know. Simply because they get involved in the community. And lo and behold, somehow, it got back to the hierarchy of baseball in itself. And they're trying to do that. I think they're at least on the right track. We have some personal issues that reflect back into our career about that. But that's just my feelings on what's going on in the English League today.
You touched on just briefly at the end. Not to get too personal, but what were your salaries back in 1969? I believe the major league average at that time was $15,000 or $16,000.
In 1966, I represented the National League in pitching negotiations with Marvin Miller. Steve Hamilton and the Yankees, who I dearly love, represented the American League in negotiations. We flew into New York, Marvin Miller, the winter of 66, and we sent him an agenda 45 days before that meeting, saying these are the list of the things that we want to discuss. And the top of the list was minimum salary. And we went up to the 42nd floor, and at that time, Bowie Kuhn, the rest of my heart, was the attorney for all the owners of baseball. This is before he was commissioner, I'll give you again. We walked into the lobby of the law firm, and we asked to speak to Bowie Kuhn. He said we have a meeting at a certain time. She called in. He comes out of the double doors, comes into the foyer, sits down in the lobby at the couch, and says, "Gee, guys, good to see you. What are we here for?" So Marvin, God love him, he said, "Well, you know, we sent you an agenda. There's several issues we want to talk about." And he said, "Well, let's get to the main topics. What are the bullet points up at the top?" He says, Marvin says, "You don't have an agenda." He says, "Nah, it's somewhere on my desk." Marvin says, "There's a copy for it." He said, "Go ahead, let me look at this thing." He said, "Number one, minimum salary. What are we talking about here?" Well, at that time, I think minimum salary was
$6,500,
thereabouts. $6,000. And my contention, we did a real strong model, financial model, is the fact that top plumbers, top electricians, people in the world like that were making almost twice their salary. Those athletes coming into the big leagues at $6,500 and had to have a home in Los Angeles and rent a house in Boston they played for had two mortgages. Our contention was we can't bring our family back to be with us during the summer on our employment because we can't afford two mortgages. We would like to have a minimum salary up to, I think we were asking, 10 or 12. He looked at that and he said, "Well, gentlemen, this is out of the question." He says, "We can't afford that." Which Marvin Miller says, "Well, since you brought that up, could we see the financials on all teams?" The big guy stood and said, "Gentlemen, as far as I'm concerned, this fucking meeting is over. Have a good day." So I wanted to kind of talk to that.
Not that you're bitter about it.
Hey, God love the fiction. It's supposed to be.
Sure, y'all, as short-sighted the owners were, they had said to the players in 1966, not only will we raise the minimum salary from $6,500 to $10,000, we'll raise it $1,000 a year for the next 50 years. The players would have taken that in a second. They wouldn't have listened to Marvin Miller. they would have accepted that as the deal, and we wouldn't have a free agency today, not only in baseball, but in all the other sports. But the owners wanted it all. They didn't want to give up anything, not even anything as reasonable as that. If they had done that, then they would have no complaints today. $10,000 and $1,000 a year for the next 50 years, I mean, you can imagine the difference the salary structure would have been between then and the way it is now.
I later on became a player representative. If you're coming to tomorrow's meeting with Dick Moss, I got very involved in it for the reasons these gentlemen are expressing. How the heck are you going to bring the best athletes in the world into baseball when you can't live on that money? You got to get a job in the off season to continue to. I was married with three kids. $6,000 a year on a claim. 1967 with the Detroit Tigers. It's ridiculous. But that represented 12% of their total revenue. We got it up as high as 40%. It's back down to 30%. Now, I know you think everybody's overpaid in Major League Baseball, but this is what I just said. It's back down to 30% of total revenue. You can point to the individual salaries of some, and as we come later, you'll hear me say this very thing later. I don't like a salary structure where 20% of the people get 80% of the money, and neither would you in the job you have. But for some reason, it exists in Major League Baseball. I like a nice bell-shaped curve that rewards people on the quality of their performances to some degree. But 12% of total revenue, boy, tune, can't come up with more? I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. In an entertainment industry, where we're the show. What do you think these entertainers get when they go into a stadium? And they think they give them 12% for the game? No. And it was difficult. They're still fighting it. I'm one of these guys that when I have a negotiation, I want what's good for both sides. And they, no matter what happened, they were not interested. They were only interested in trying to keep you down. Well, that builds an animosity that I don't feel is necessary. Wouldn't it be nice if we were equal partners and we both worked as hard as we could to help everybody? And what was talking about earlier, this loyalty. When we became free agent, I don't know if you know this, but there was one person that was on the player side that was against it. I didn't like it, and the reason I didn't like it was for the very reason that's happened today. If you're going to have free agency after 6 years, what's the supply and demand being on that? How many six-year players are you going to have? Well, most people don't get 4 years of service. So the only guys that get 6 years are the guys that are highly talented. They become free agents. So now they get to negotiate their salaries openly, while the rest of you got to take what you can get. That really is about what it is. It brings about this kind of a left-of-curtain curve distribution. And I voted against it for that reason. I agreed with Charlie Finley. Those of you that remember Charlie, he said, let them all be free agents after every year. Supply and demand, though you understand economics. I thought he was right. But so I was the one abstaining, and I think the harm to it is exactly what he did. We lost the disconnect. Okay, if I'm playing for a team, I want to be there and play the whole, you establish your roots there, you establish a house there, you have your family there, and now they trade. Well, how would you like to have that happen in your business? You don't like it either. So now you have to have either two places or half ignore it. Well, no, in the off season when you can contribute to the community, when you can be a part of what's going on, during the season, you've got enough on your mind. And I'm sorry, you just got enough on your mind trying to get the greatest hitters in the world out, or trying to hit the greatest pitchers in the world. And what we need to do is get people that, if you develop a player in your organization, you should be there the rest of his career if you want him. I know players don't like that. But I think that for the better fun of baseball, that's the way it should have been. And the salary should have been a percentage of the total revenue, and the Players Association distributed equitably in whatever way the Players Association wants, and get all negotiations out of the process so that we could be partners, and not only with the owners, but with the people in each town. But it didn't go that way. Always trying to squeeze that extra damn dime out of us.
See why they had to get rid of Mike?
Pilots, what's your memories of Joe Schultz, our beloved man? Jim, you want to start off?
I was a kid in my career, so I can get a different viewpoint. Almost like Charlie Finley, I thought he was a great businessman.
But Joe Schulze was a love. He knew exactly what he had. He knew exactly where he was going to end up during the season. And he was just trying to get through the year, putting something on the field, get through the games, and have a good time. And after every game, win, lose, or draw, he'd come to the clubhouse, he says, "Batta boy, guys, pound that Budweiser in the air." I promise I'm not getting stock in Budweiser. I want to make a comment here. I think to set the record straight. First of all, I feel extremely blessed by God that I was able to play a sport that I was passionate about. It's been good to me through all my career. It's been very, very good. But having said that, in the business world that I'm in now, you look at baseball, and I answer this to a lot of people when they discuss the salaries, $4 million, $25 million a year, whatever, and they say, how in the world can this happen? How can they afford that? It's a simple business model. Steinbrenner's fixed asset for his franchise in New York, along with broadcasting, all the other things that pertain to it, and is worth $900 million at least. And you look around the industry, and every franchise goes up fixed asset and value. It really doesn't matter what the payroll or operational budget is. It's simple arithmetic for the industry. So I just want to throw that out there.
Don't get me started on Steinbrenner. In his defense, I will say the Yankees payroll, like, is somewhere around just over $200 million this year. And meanwhile, Florida Marlins payroll is $15
million. And the Yankees is only 5% of total revenue, and the Marlins is 30%.
Right, and the Marlins are getting, I think, probably $30 to $40 million just in revenue. And yet their payroll is only $15 million. But anyway. That's a discussion for another time. Chip, how about your thoughts on Mr. Schulze?
Well, how much time do we have?
What was his favorite expression?
Well, it was a toss-up. Chip fuck and fuck shit. You can use them interchangeably depending on the situation. Talk to a college in Massachusetts, and I base it upon Joe Schulze's philosophy, which was rendered after we've lost about 10 straight. We just lost a doubleheader. We're sitting there in the dugout before the game. A couple of guys sitting in there, got in there early. Joe comes walking into the dugout about 2.5 hours before the game. He looks around, and he says, "All right, men, up and at him, fuck them all, let it all hang out."
So was your quiz to address everything I need to know in life by listening to a show?
I broke it down. Up and at him means you gotta get up and you gotta get going. Fuck them all means can't be bothered about what the naysayers, what anybody says, you gotta do it anyway, and let it all hang out, but you gotta give 100% for what you're doing. I expanded on that a little bit.
Wise words.
I could help to have a PhD in a locker room of professional athletes.
Mike, did you have any dealings with Joe?
No, Joe, he was a sweetheart. You know, that language, it's a shame. I'm going to tell it quick. I don't use the profanity. It's not part of my daily life.
You don't know the word.
It's sort of subliminal. If I'm coaching college ball, something happens, and I hear what I say. And I'm play coaching at a Catholic college, and my brother's sitting there. Look out with me. We got to clean this up, but there's no chance in it, folks. So don't hold it against Joe Schulze. That's just the crudeness, unfortunately, of professional athletes. See, there's no reason to admire us. You understand that. Well, Jim Britton said it right. He said, we're 2 weeks before the end of the season. He said, 2 weeks I can have my own friends. Very nice man. He got right in the hotel, not at the ballpark. He doesn't talk like that. He's a gentle, kind soul, given an impossible, what he thought was an impossible situation. I would have looked at it a little more positively, although I agree that not anything against the guys toward the end of their career, man. But getting a bunch of younger guys like Kansas City went and let us struggle while learning and being more open to our creativity and what we're trying to do and encouraging us might have worked out a little better.
I believe that Jim was a coach of the Cardinals just before.
Yes, that's why I had Budweiser.
Yeah.
Distributorship, so
fine, all you want. So Joe went from one of the great dynasties of the 60s to the Seattle Pilots, so maybe that explains his language. Steve, you were with the Pilots in 69, also in spring training, and then with the Brewers. What was it like down in Tempe when you found out that the Pilots weren't going to be playing in Seattle?
Well, we were in spring training, and like you say, to begin with, we were the Seattle Pilots, but we knew during spring training that franchise was going, we just didn't know where. So it came up to the, as I remember it, it was the last day of spring training. We still didn't know where we were going.
It was sort of the motto of the Seattle Pilots.
There was my wife would call and say, I didn't bring her down because we had no idea, you know, where we were going to end up. And as I remember, it was New Orleans or Toronto. Finally, it was Milwaukee. And so all in one fell swoop, we climbed on a plane and flew to Milwaukee. And got out of the plane, and as I remember, it was cold and ice on the runway. And we walk into the terminal, and you know, we haven't seen anyone yet. All of a sudden, we get into the terminal, and it's pandemonium. There's thousands of people in there. And I turned to the guy next to me, and I said, I hope they don't think I'm Henry Aaron. Going to spring training and you have no idea where you're going to end up.
Did they rip the Pilots off the jerseys and replace it with Brewers? Is that?
I don't remember that specifically. I remember the uniform being a lot similar.
Seattle Pilots caps with the scrambled egg design, and I'd like to get some opinions on what it was like to wear that cap very proudly. Did you get mistaken for actual pilots when you were in the airport?
We had no idea that one day our uniforms would be worth more than we were.
Athletics with those gorgeous green and gold colors and white shoes. This was going up.
Did any of you, speaking of your uniforms, any of you save some memorabilia from the Pilots? Do you have some?
I got a cap at home. I got the original cap. Maybe it'll be Pilots. It was a 56. Are you 56?
Yeah.
It's Pilots.
What's a fire now?
As I said earlier, we know most about the Pilots and remember a lot about the Pilots thanks to Ball 4. Jim, can you just talk about the reaction that you got with Ball 4? I mean, I remember just talking with players, even today, in the last few years, I've asked them about Ball 4, and they said, some of them still said, I won't read that book, because they were still so upset about it. You know, it was about people who are basically their grandfather. But
Why? And I must say, as a sports writer, it is my career goal to one time write a sentence that is as beautiful as, you spend your life tripping a baseball, and then in the end you find out it was the other way around all the time. It's a great closing to your book. But why do you think ball four angers so many people?
You know, I think most of the players were angry about a few things they heard about the book. Because most of the guys didn't read, I don't think, from start to finish. Some may have. Most of the guys heard this line or that line and just thought it was a terrible thing to have in the book. If they had read the book and read these things in context of the larger story, I think they would have had a different view of it.
Did you ever at some point think, when you were writing it, and think, these guys didn't know I was going to be quoting them on this? Did you ever think, I should write that? And basically, I guess I'm asking, where are the outtakes? What did the...
I'm holding those, which is one of the reasons why the criticism wasn't as bad as it could have been. I did. It was not a tell-all book. Tell some book. I didn't quote anybody making anti-Semitic remarks. I didn't quote anybody making racial comments. I have certainly heard enough of those. All the sexy stories are anonymous. The only really sexy story which I named names was when Nan Bell, Bobby and I were out to dinner. My first wife and I were out to dinner with Nan and Gary Bell, and Nan told the story about the time she called Gary when he was on a road trip at 3 o'clock in the morning, and his roommate, Woody Held, answered the phone. Nan says, "Where's Gary?" And Woody said, "He's out playing golf." Which is the best Woody could do it free, you know. Quoted as a betrayal of Gary Bell's private life, and nobody thought that was any funnier than Gary himself. And Dan had told the story, so obviously whatever problem she had with where Gary might have been at 3 o'clock had already been resolved, but that was used against me as an example of betraying somebody's confidence. But I was aware that the players had some rights to privacy, and I tried to have that balance there, and I think the guys as likable and human, as I could. There were some guys who I started the season with. I never really liked Fred Talbot, for example. I just didn't like the guy. But now, as a writer, I started listening to what he had to say, and he became a wonderful character, very, very funny. I actually liked Fred Talbot a lot. That's one of the funniest guys. So the process of writing the book opened up my eyes to other people and listening to what they have to say and appreciating them. And I feel like I had a full appreciation for my teammates. I feel that Ball Four shows that, I loved them then, as I do now. And I don't think I would have had that feeling today if I hadn't paid attention and written all that stuff down.
Let's keep in mind, everybody knew he was writing. It wasn't a secret. He would sit there and he'd talk to you and you'd say, "Okay, I'm writing a book." I had the blessing of getting to read it in its rawest form. And I thought that it was a celebration. I thought it was funny. I thought it made us all look far better than we were. He made us look human and vulnerable and struggling and all the things that we were. And I thought cut out most of the bad stuff that we all had when we were young and stupid. We all had the fun. But I was proud of the book when I first read it. I thought it was a brilliant job. And it showed the society there. It's just the everyday people that happen to have a shared love. And you probably have it in your workplace. just as we had it in our workplace. You could write the same book about the people you work with, just who gives a damn, get on with it.
You know, you have to look at the times, too. We weren't free agents. We were chattel mortgage with a ball club. And the old system of don't rock the boat. And I will say this, Jim and I laugh a lot. We talk about the mechanics and industry and the business of baseball. We sit in the bullpen and talk, and you hear me rant and rave. And today, my business partner today says, I'll bring Pat Maroney in when the emotions are out of the deal. And it's just how we are. But as far as Jim's book, I thought it was great. He just did shop talk. It wasn't malicious. And in today's media world, good Lord, you know, if you pass gas in the morning, they'll tell you what you had for breakfast yesterday. And that's really it. So those that, I honestly believe those that see stones in our industry towards the book or reference to Jim simply was saying what they thought other people wanted to hear.
It is a wonderful book, and as you said, Mike and Jim, and said, it made all the players just seem so human and so much more interesting and likable and funny than, and that was the impression I just, you brought people to life, and that, I think that's the beauty of it, is that this team that existed only for 1 year is still alive thanks to that book.
Well, I mean, if you want being vicious, you should read the book that Jim and my ex-wife wrote about us.
They'll be in for
they didn't tell us you were writing a book.
Home run for the money, and what happened with Fred Talbot. Could you relate that one for us?
Well, this was late in the season, I think, or middle of the season, something like that, and there's a contest they ran on the radio then called Home Run for the Money, where fans would send in a card or a postcard or something like that, and then at a particular moment in the game, one of their cards would be drawn out of a hat, and if the batter hit a home run at that at-bat, then they won $5,000, and if a player hit a grand slam home run, it would have been $25,000. I'm sure they had insurance to cover all of that. So anyway, we were sitting down in the bullpen, and we were listening to the game on the radio, as we always did, because we wanted to find out how much the broadcasters were ragging on us. So we're listening to the game, and as we're watching the game, we're listening to the broadcast, and of course, we're all chuckling when Fred Talbot comes to bat, hits a home run, it's a grand slam home run, and of course, Shonley's talking about home run for the money, and that's $25,000 to Donald DuBois of Gladstone, Oregon, you know? Anyway, Fred hadn't rounded second yet before it was decided that he should receive a telegram thanking him for the home run and promising to send him $5,000. T. Talbot, and of course, there's the telegram. They're sitting on his desk. I hand delivered it a couple hours before the game, and so it's sitting on Fred's stool. And of course, everybody in the locker room knows that that's a fake $5,000 for Fred. He walks in there, and of course, everybody's watching him out of the corner of their eye. He looks at this telegram, smiles, and puts it back in his pocket. Throws it, has a cigarette, comes back, looks at it again, still $5,000. Anyway, we play the game, the game's over, and now we're leaving the airport. We got to fly out of town or something, and I think it's on the back of the bus, and it was either Ray Oiler or Mayor Bernou, who was Fred Talbot's roommate. I think it was Ray Oiler. And Ray, of course, you know, who knows what's going on, he said to Fred, Fred,
Oh, Fred's talking about what he's going to do with the $5,000. He's going to buy a boat and tell his wife he won it in a raffle. Put the $5,000 in the bank. So anyway, at that moment, Ray, you know, pressing the envelope, says to Fred, he said, Fred, you think that's real? He said, you know, it could be one of the guys playing a trick. You know? He says, nah, if it was one of the guys, he wouldn't have misspelled my name. And then the aftermath to that, of course, is time goes by, and about two weeks later, they're going to have another celebration of Fred's home run. And so what they do is they have a moment where they're going to present the bat. Fred is asked to give the bat that he hit the home run with two Donald DuBois. So they're going to fly to Gladstone or someplace like that. Fred drives to the airport, spends $12.50 for parking, gets on the plane, goes to Gladstone, gives the bat to Donald DuBois, who, of course, Donald never mentions the $5,000. Mystified about that, but he comes back. And then another week goes by, and somebody says, Fred, what happened to the $5,000 for Donald DuBois? He says, yeah, I never heard from him. And all, like, it cost me $12.50 for parking. Then home run for the money happens again, and this time Jim Pagliarone wins $5,000, right, Jim? He wins $5,000, and he does get some money. What did you get, $100?
Yes.
Now they send Fred $100 for the $5,000 as a token of appreciation for winning the guy $5,000. So immediately we do a calculation as to what Fred should have gotten from the $25,000. And somebody says to Fred, I wonder what Donald DuBois did with that $25,000. And Fred says, I hope you bought a new car and you crashed it and killed him. You set out to write a novel. You couldn't come up with a better story than that. I mean, these guys were characters out of a novel, and I am so lucky that I was on the pilots, because I could have never written the exact same kind of book, or even close to it, with another type of team. The beauty of the pilots were, they were all older guys. Every one of them was a great storyteller. Here they were, playing together for the first time, and of course some of them knew each other, but they were really getting to know each other through the exchanging of stories with this team and that team. So here I am, I'm on a team with a bunch of great old storytellers. I caught lightning in a bottle, and it was just the baseball commissioner had put this team together and said, you know, these guys are not going to win many games, but if anybody writes a book, this would be a hell of a team.
I think we did that just for you. Home run for the money. Can you think of, but cross commercialization, thank God we don't have any of that in our broadcast. So. At this point, I'm going to open it up to questions from all you. Does anybody have any questions in general for them or specific for anybody? You?
I'd like to ask Steve. Steve, what was it like to be a leader and a thinker in a baseball world that didn't seem to value that?
You had a reputation for being an intellectual, reading Dostoevsky, and asking whether that was correct.
So what was that like? Dealing with a bunch of guys that probably didn't value that too much.
Well, number one, I didn't think of myself that way, because 2 years prior to that, I had been a jock in college, and so now on the baseball team, I'm the intellectual. Somewhere in between. And I must have had, well, I can remember exactly. You're going to college and you're taking classes and so forth. Now all of a sudden you have a job where you have a lot of free time. So I did read some books that I'd always wanted to read.
And I guess one day I must have had one in my paperback in my hip pocket. So that not only gets noticed by the other ball players, but gets immortalized in print. You have a copy of The Possessed or something in your pocket now. I don't know what significance there is in that.
He was very kind to me. He came up to me one day and says, "Hey, don't try three syllables. It doesn't work for you."
Not a specific question, but I wanted to refresh everybody's memories. I pulled up the home run log while I was talking with Jim out in the lobby and discovered that according to the home run log, on July 19, 1969, he hit a home run off Jim Cott. And I showed him that we could hit a link and pull up the retro sheet account of the game. Fascinating game. It was actually suspended after 15 innings and resumed the next day, July 20th. And before the game was completed in the 17th inning, there was a 20-minute delay while the moon landing occurred. And this was, Jim, you referred to the doubleheader on the moon landing day. It was actually the completion of the game from the night before, and then the game that succeeded it. Jim, you hit a home run in the bottom of the 15th to retie the game off of Jim Cott, who'd come in three innings earlier as a pinch hitter for Ron Karnowski. Jim, you started that game. Do you recall being taken out in the fourth inning after giving up two home runs?
I had forgotten that.
Let's
thank you for reminding me.
Yeah, the second one was to their leadoff hitter, Hugh Andrews. Steve, do you recall your line from that game? You were 4-10.
I don't recall it.
Anyway, thank you very much. Oh, and Mike, you were perhaps the only pitcher on the team that did not pitch in that game.
Probably his favorite.
Thank you. I believe I've reached the age where I don't remember everything quite as clearly as I intend. Mike, did you pitch in the game in which Henry Aaron hit his 750th home run?
This is where the Dodgers say Dowling gave up a home run. I came in afterward.
Did you climb the fence because the gate would not open?
No. Sorry about that. Tom House tried to climb it, and no, it was Bill Buckner in left field tried to climb it to get Henry's home run ball. But I came in for the gate, I'm pretty sure.
All kinds of crazy things happened. The stadium was full at the beginning of the game. But after the home run, by the time you entered the game, I believe there was 10,000 people left in the stadium. But somebody climbed the fence, I don't know.
I want to know if he could reminisce about, or probably not something he wants to reminisce about leaving Milwaukee the next year over the non-payment of a fine by Dave Bristol.
What happened on that one was that a lot of the pitchers had been coming in on days that they weren't pitching. They've been taking extra time to get. You had, number one, you had to be at the ballpark 3 hours before the game. Okay, so some of the pitchers had not been getting there at that time. So Dave Bristol, he had a meeting and he imposed a fine on anyone who was less than 3 hours before the game arriving at the park. Well, at the time, my family and I were staying at a lake, which was
I would say 15 or 20 miles out of town. My alarm clock didn't go off. So I get into the park 15 to 20 minutes late, if you consider the 3 hours before the game being the time you have to get there. So to make a long story short, the fine was imposed, and right off the top, I didn't really agree with the whole idea of being able to take somebody's money without recourse. It was kind of a principle, and so I didn't pay the fine. And what I was told, well, number one, we didn't have a phone at the cottage where we were staying, so I had to go into the park and talk to Marvin Noakes. I was told that I would be suspended, and then a week later I was told that I would be traded, and this whole time they were working on a deal. So I ended up getting traded to Oakland, and I got right on the plane and went to Detroit where Oakland was, met John McNamara, the manager, and he said, welcome to the team. It's real good to have you, but I don't know what we're going to do with it. And Reggie Jackson, Rick Monday, Joe Rudy in the outfield. So that was the beginning of my career as a pinch hitter.
It's over here.
Yes, I have a question for Jim. You talk a lot of, you're talking about amphetamine use or brainies, and I was just wondering, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, so I only read about this. When the book came out, it seemed like they were more concerned about, you know, all the body sex stories and things like that rather than, you know, the amphetamine use. And I was just wondering, why do you think it wasn't really investigated then, and why do you think that it's so shocking now?
Well, I don't think it's shocking for people. I don't think people are really shocked about it. Clearly, amphetamine use was rampant in the 1960s, and probably before then, greenies were just, you know, part of the culture. I'm not sure. What was the first part of your question?
Why do you think it wasn't really investigated then?
Because baseball owners traditionally have been very, very short-sighted people. They can postpone a decision or not take care of something, they just won't do anything about it. And eventually, it went away, and they haven't had to deal with it until recently. Now they've got to do something. They wait until they're forced to do something, and then they have a major problem on their hands. But that's been their history for many, many years.